are moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of their skin. Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
Well, this will be... It's something. We're back. Welcome to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar. Another Oscar Sprint profile for your listening pleasure. Pleasure in quotes, I guess, because we're going to handle this one with care as best we can. We're doing Black Klansman. That's the Oscar Sprint profile. We want to start off with a warning. Obviously, we are two suburban white men from Connecticut, as we've said. So this is going to be all from our perspectives. Obviously, this is a very heavy movie, a very heavy issue, a very ongoing issue in society. So we can only talk about the perspectives that we were born into and that we have from this point in life. We don't mean to talk about these in blanket statements as if they're universal truths or anything like that, but we're going to do our best to analyze it and break it down as film critics as we are. I am your co-host, Mike One. This is co-host also Mike.
Also Mike here. This movie is a political statement in many ways. It makes political statements. We're not going to shy away from them.
And I thought they were hidden well, at least.
I think if you know us by now, we are both Democrats. We voted blue for a while,
sure.
So we're going to try and be honest with you at bottom line.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we always kind of default to. If nothing else, we tell you the truth, whether or not we like a movie or whether or not you should see a movie, and right down to what we think about these kind of political... you called this a propaganda piece, and I think that's pretty accurate about what this is in layman's terms.
Yeah, parts of it, it's a hit piece. Parts of it's a hit piece against the current administration. You and I are not against that necessarily.
Nope.
I want to see it again.
Right.
Because it's pretty dense and what it's doing. And yes, I guess we should just get right into it, right?
Yeah, we'll start with cast and crew. But again, just want to lay out for you guys. We're going to try to keep this as funny and normal as we can. But again... At the same time, we understand that not everyone would be a fan of seeing this. We're going to be cognizant of that, but not really pull any punches on our end. So, Mike, we'll start with cast and crew and all those notes.
Is this movie just a metaphor for the last 17 years of the New York Knicks?
Basically.
Spike Lee, yes, just going there with it?
All right, I'm just surprised there wasn't a seven-foot Latvian at the middle of it.
Let's push that as a theme of our episode, then. No. All right, here we go. Co-written and directed by Spike Lee. We gave him the full bio filmography treatment during our 1989 Best Original Screenplay episode.
You should have won.
Yeah, episode 72 there. Do the Right Thing, lost to Dead Poets Society. We were very aggravated by that fact.
Yeah.
Some of my favorite Spike Lee films include 25th Hour, He Got Game, probably my top two. How about you, Mike?
25th Hour I bought when I was like, I think, a junior or sophomore in college, and your brother, it's been a running ongoing joke with he and I because...
Oh my God. This is another stubborn meta joke. You're not watching a great movie like 25th
it's
Hour
in
just
the plastic wrap.
To antagonize my brother?
More or less. And it's honestly been like an 8-year running gag about how I'm going to watch it this weekend and just never do it. Yes, I have not seen 25th Hour yet. My favorite Spike Lee movie, Inside Man, was really good, but it's not like a quote-unquote Spike Lee movie. There's not like a big racial and political message in that, as there are in like, say, Chirac or Do the Right Thing. Do the Right Thing, I really, really enjoyed. Summer of Sam, I really enjoyed. So
yes.
Those are probably two of my top ones.
There's a huge filmography. Go back and watch a bunch of them. I remember being angry with Spike in the late 90s because of how he antagonized Reggie Miller. I was still too young. To really watch his movies yet. I was like 12, 11, and I was like, this film director just caused Reggie Miller to ruin my life.
Sitting courtside, lit a fire under Reggie Miller.
I'm kidding. And as soon as I got into high school, I started watching Spike Lee movies, and I just couldn't stop. So yeah, get into his filmography. Go back to that previous episode to listen to his bio there. Writing credits for Black Klansman go to Charlie Wachtel and David Rabinowitz. It's their first feature film screenplay credit to both of them.
Welcome to the show, guys.
Kevin Willamette and Spike also worked on Chirac together. They've collaborated several times. They both get credits for the screenplay as well. I think they kind of took the baton from the first two guys day here. Black Klansman stars John David Washington as Ron Stallworth. Yes, he is the son of Denzel. He's best known from Ballers on HBO. I did not realize, Mike, he was Denzel Washington's son going into the...
Did not know that either. I learned that just now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Going into my first watch, I had no idea.
That's why I laughed. I was like, oh, okay, wow.
I went home. I started preparing this. I wanted to listen to a bunch of promotional videos, and they're like, son of Denzel. Then I couldn't stop hearing Denzel Washington's voice.
Oh, yeah, now that you say it, certainly.
I even went to the movie again yesterday, and I just could not stop hearing Denzel's voice, even though he's putting on, you know, the white voice quite a bit.
White officers, yeah.
It's pretty amazing. So... John David Washington's other acting credits, obviously Ballers on HBO. He played in the NFL. John David Washington did. He played for the CFL and the Arena League. He bounced around in Euro League for a while.
Man of many talents.
He plays a receiver on Ballers. I watched a couple episodes of Ballers. I haven't watched that whole series.
I'm going to get into it. I know once I do, I will love it because it's The Rock and I'm a simple man.
It's about agents, lawyers who are... Yeah.
All I wanted to do with my life.
His other acting credits are Love Beats Rhymes, Monsters and Men, and 2018's Monster. Not the Charlize Theron Academy Award vehicle. He'll also continue his breakout year in the film The Old Man and the Gun from David Lowery coming out a few months from now.
That gives me hope for that movie, at least. The preview looked so boring.
Yeah, you're not a fan.
I wasn't crazy
Sissy
about it.
Sissy Spacek, Robert Redford,
yeah,
tete-a-tete.
But maybe John David Washington is. He interests me.
It's pretty cool to see Spike Lee and son of Denzel work together after Denzel and Spike kind of built their careers
up Magic
together.
About 20 years ago.
Isn't that
fun? And now they're coming full circle here. That is kind
of
cool.
Rest of the cast, I'm going to try to rip through these quick, but a lot of big names. Adam Driver stars as Flip Zimmerman, best known HBO's Girls, Star Wars, Force Awakens, Last Jedi, Logan Lucky, Meyerowitz Story, Silence, Patterson, Midnight Special, This Is Where I Leave You, Lincoln, Francis, Ha, J. Edgar.
Do you think he's more well known for Star Wars or for Girls now?
For me, it's Star Wars.
It has to be Star Wars,
I watched
right?
the first couple seasons of Girls. I couldn't keep going with it.
You watched? I didn't watch it. Anyway, I'm a bad person.
Laura Harrier from Spider-Man Homecoming is one of those faces I just couldn't place. I know her. Who is she? Spider-Man Homecoming. Patrice Dumas. She's the head of the Black Student Union.
She was awesome, too, in this.
Topher Grace from That 70s Show plays David Duke.
He was so awful and so good.
Corey Hawkins from Straight Outta Compton. Dr. Dre from Straight Outta Compton. And 24 Legacy plays Kwame Ture. Paul Walter Hauser. Sean from I, Tonya plays Ivanhoe.
And I knew, I was so scared for like the first half hour of him being on screen because I was like, why am I enjoying this guy's dialogue so much? He's a terrible KKK member. He's an open racist. It's
like
why
the
am
Lenny
I?
Lenny cartoon character. Where did he go, George?
Yeah,
where did he
I'm
go?
Like, why am I liking him? And then I asked you. I was like, you told me he was from I, Tonya, and of course that character from I, Tonya is one of my all time favorite characters in movies. I love that guy. So that's why I was. Oh,
he's
yeah.
eating in every scene in I, Tonya. This movie's almost like drinking in every scene.
Yeah, so he's got that mouth fixation.
He's right that's hard to do.
He's Brad Pitt, is what I'm saying.
Yes. Ryan Eggold from The Blacklist plays Walter Breachway. Ashley Atkinson from Compliance. I remember her in Compliance. Very good in that. Connie Kendrickson. The Kendricksons are a force of nature, awful nature in this movie. As Jasper Pekonen from Vikings. He's very scary on Vikings. He plays Felix Kendrickson, as menacing as they come.
Sure.
I love the rest of the cast, too, and I'm just trying to rip them off fast. Robert John Burke from Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is Chief Bridges. He's awesome in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind as the secret
that,
CIA trainer guy.
That's a crazy story in and of itself. and it shares with this. This is a true story, much like Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is based on a true story.
He's a perfect police chief in this. Isaiah Whitlock Jr. is from 25th Hour, Cedar Rapids, The Wire. He's Mr. Turrentine. His catchphrase is one of the best in the business. She.
They worked it into this one,
too. It worked
in
the beginning of this movie. Spike knows exactly how to use Mr. Whitlock there. Brian Tarantino is Officer Clay Mulaney. He's from Uncle Buck. He's early on in this film in the records room. Also the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Ken Garrido from Crash and Summer of Sand plays Sergeant Trapp. He got some big jokes in this movie. Ken Garrido. Spike Lee's a generous director, man. Michael Buscemi, brother of Steve, best known from Nurse Jackie, plays Jimmy Creek. So again, it's kind of like a weird legacy thing going on. Spike Lee movies. Spike used Steve Buscemi before. So there
he's
we go.
He's like working with the same families, I guess, huh?
Yeah, there's a big cameo in the opening shots of this film. We won't talk about it yet, but we'll talk about it later. Some story inception notes here, Mike. It's based on the nonfiction, true story, Black Klansman, written by Ron Stallworth himself.
Detective Ron Stallworth.
Detective Stallworth disobeyed the order to destroy evidence of this case after it finished because he believed it was an unjust order. And it was such a unique case that he, years later, he wanted to have something to call back to and something to prove what he did. He didn't know he was going to write a book at the time, but after he retired, he's like, I think I need to.
I read an article on NPR that said John David Washington actually met the real Detective Ron Stallworth in preparation for this role, and he had the actual KKK membership card still has it, pass it around to him and Spike Lee, and they said it was just so wild, and they started making jokes about it and all that.
Stallworth has praised the film for its accuracy. He does say Spike took liberties. Obviously, the real event occurred in 1979. They pushed it back to 1971, 72 in the film. But for the most part, Stallworth says they got it right. He says he had a lot of fun fooling David Duke back in the day.
How could you not? It's so devious, but it's so, how would you not?
And disproving all his views on racial superiority. So that seems to me, it tells me that they got the tone right in this movie, because you have a lot of serious stuff treated with serious care, but when you're inside the police station, these guys are laughing and joking, and they're having fun for the most part.
There's a lot of big laughs in this movie overall, but it's always nice when you have a film based on a true story that the actual character gives it their seal of approval as well, because that is certainly not always the case in Hollywood.
Stallworth, again, the real Ron Stallworth, he spent his life knowing there are threats on him from the KKK. So we're going to talk about that as having a reverberating effect. So obviously a real hero, courageous man in blue, to be sure. Production notes here. 2015, QC Entertainment and film producer Sean Reddick, they began adapting the book by Ron Stallworth into a screenplay.
Producers attached to this film, too, are some big names. I'm going to get into them in specs, but yeah.
After the success of Get Out, both Blumhouse and Jordan Peele's production company, Monkey Paw Productions, got behind the project
did.
Apparently, Jordan Peele made the call to Spike. He pitched the film simply: a black man infiltrates the KKK. Six words, if you count KKK as one word.
And how much more does Spike need than that? I mean, how juicy is that?
Yeah, Spike's like, that's all I really needed after a few follow-up questions, because I just like, is this the David Chappelle skit? No. Peele's like, no, it's a true story, Spike. So Spike knew he was interested from the jump there. He feels
would have been a very different movie if it was the Chappelle skit.
Spike feels that this film is about today. It's very, very contemporary, he says. Could just not be a period stuff, is what Spike, he did not want to make
not a period
just a simple
piece,
period
by the way.
Film.
I mean, the aesthetics are there, the set design is there to make you know that it's the 70s, but this is not a period piece.
Yeah, so to continue that quote, Spike said, we had to put stuff in there to connect this crazy world to the world we live in today.
And they did a great job.
So obviously, this movie was a huge hit at Cannes Film Festival, and Mike, you got a bunch of specs.
Yeah, it did win a couple awards at the Cannes Film Festival, Cannes, as we like to call it. Black Klansman, specs for Black Klansman, written and directed by Spike Lee, with screenplay credits also, as also Mike told you. Charlie Wachtel, who doesn't have much of a history that I could find. David Rabinowitz, who, like Wachtel, had written and produced a bunch of shorts prior to this. And Kevin Wilmot, who co-wrote Chi-Raq with Lee and was listed as an executive producer on that film as well. Also, Mike told you all that. This is Lee's first solo feature-length directorial project since 2015, Chi-Raq, but his stature as being the voice of the oppressed, the lead of the racial empowerment movement, dates all the way back from his film school days when he was acing school projects such as She's Got to Have It. The specifics about this film itself are each important in their own right, none more so than who is listed as a producer in this movie's wiki page. Also, Mike just told you, Blumhouse had a chance in it, Jordan Peele. You know about Spike Lee. Maybe you're aware of Sean Reddick, Sean McKittrick, and Raymond Mansfield, but writer-director of the 2017 breakout film Get Out, Jordan Peele is also a producer, as is Jason Blum. Are there two hotter producer-director names out there right now than Peele and Blum that decided to come together for this property to tell this story through the lens of Spike Lee? I mean, how much power, how much juice can one film have behind it right now? And obviously, these are three men that have great stature in Hollywood, but also feel this message needs to be displayed and told ad nauseum right now.
For my money, I feel the influence of Jordan Peele.
Oh, without question.
In this. You know, you feel the influence of Jason Blum and that studio in this movie.
I was most surprised to learn Jordan Peele was a surprise to see him come on, but I didn't know about Jason Blum's involvement until I started doing research. Mm-hmm. And then retroactively, you think back, I could see that.
Yeah, this is a little purgy.
Right, yeah, totally. Absolutely, yeah. 135-minute runtime on an R rating, no shit. Produced by Blumhouse, Monkey Paw, 40 Acres and a Mule. Those are, of course, Jason Blum's, Jordan Peele's, and Spike Lee's production company, as well as QC Entertainment and Legendary Entertainment. Distributed by Focus Features and Universal, it debuted May 14th, 2018 at Cannes and went wide August 10th, so just a couple of days ago in the U.S. Not so coincidentally, it went wide exactly 364 days after the Charlottesville protests of 2017. A lot of tiki torches sold on that day. A $15 million budget, which you can absolutely see, as many of Spike's properties are relatively low budget. But unlike previous Spike pictures, this one has a chance to make quite a bit of ROI, return on its investments, even if that is quite clearly a secondary concern of the auteurs. Of Spike Lee's 22 listed feature-length films on Box Office Mojo, only 6 have ever grossed beyond $20 million domestically. And only 2 have ever had an opening weekend in excess of $10 million. Those were 2 relatively big national releases, The Inside Man and The Kings of Comedy. BlacKkKlansman, again on a $15 million budget, after its first opening weekend, raked in $10.8 million domestically.
Yes.
After only 3 days, and over $11 million if you count the international box office rake thus far. Meaning that it's on its way. It's one of Spike's probably biggest openings, certainly in a decade or so. People are coming out to see this. We're going to talk about the ramifications of that as we go on. Very clearly, and more important to Spike Lee and the numerous top-line producers, is the way the message of the film and the movie specifically is received by the public, and waves have certainly been made in that area as well. Spike won the Grand Jury Prize of the Jury at Cannes. He won the Prize of the Ecumenical Jury at Cannes. I'm sure I mispronounced that. And the film finished as a Palme d'Or nominee, while finishing with numerous other Best Film Award nominees for other award circuits as well. It carries with it a 7.5 IMDb rating on 4,100 plus reviews, 97% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating on 185 reviews, only 6 of those being negative, with an average critical score of 8.2 out of 10. It went 43 for 43 and a 100% amongst tops Rotten Tomato critics. 78% audience score on 1,900 plus reviews, average score of 3.9 out of 5. It carries an 83 Metascore, which is actually up a point since we touched on this movie last week during one of our other reviews. Of its 50 reviews thus far, substantiating its Meta rating of an 83, it has 7 scores of a perfect 100, another 14 scores of an 88 or higher. The lowest scores are a 60 from Peter Bradshaw of The Guardian, whose biggest complaint about the movie was essentially that it wasn't as clever or wink-wink as Get Out was, since Jordan Peele was attached. Obviously, that's the parallel that he was able to draw from this. And a 30 from Allison Wilkinson of Vox, who was very, I thought, was ironic in her biggest complaint, which was something you actually brought up when we were talking about this before we hit record.
Yeah.
That it was too on the nose. It was too black or white, pardon the pun. It was too, people like this don't actually exist, and it didn't, it wanted to make sure you didn't miss the message, and that's why it had the message in big blinking neon lights at times. We'll talk about that as we go into it. I think all that is purposeful, but we had a little bit of a conversation, and there's a lot of ways to see something like this film. Obviously, it does carry a very heavy message, and it probably could mean a couple different things to a couple different people at points. Those are the specs. That's BlacKkKlansman in a nutshell.
I wanted to point out the numbers here before we start. Eighth grade numbers in the 90s. The Rider, we've kind of talked about on Twitter recently. Numbers in the 90s. We have 7.5, 82, and then an 83. Those kind of key critical grade numbers for this movie. So not necessarily beloved by critics the same way some of these other films have been that we've been reviewing lately.
No, it doesn't have that, oh my God, high water mark, but at the same time, we've been on record. Anything above an 80 when you get to a Metacritic stage, that's a big deal. I mean, Shape of Water last year, I think, won the best picture. It was an 80 clean, if not a little lower. So that matters when you get up that kind of echelon. And the fact that not only is it being critically received well, but the audience score was almost an 80 in and of itself.
Audience score is fairly high.
There's a lot of juice behind this one right now.
On that note, my expectations were a little too high for this movie, I think.
Okay.
You know, I come away liking this movie, to tease my review, liking it a lot and respecting it a lot. But I think my first watch, I was a bit frustrated coming out of theater. You were trying to engage me in some dialogue.
And
I was
always like, very reserved when you first leave any movie, though. Yeah, I will say that. You like to collect your thoughts.
I try to think about it, and this one I was just pissed off because this movie pissed me off. Yeah. This made me very, very angry, and I was just angry at the whole world. I was angry for a couple different reasons, if I'm honest.
Sure.
I was angry for one reason. I was arguing with a Trump supporter that whole week. It's like ongoing argument, just really frustrating, where I was trying to find some common ground. And
Did you bash your head in the wall afterwards? I'm sick of arguing
with Trump supporters.
Feel better about yourself?
My tiny cross to bear compared to this movie and these real characters. It's nothing, of course. So I'm in the mindset where I'm, you know, I have Republican friends and relatives. I'm trying to figure some stuff out.
I mean, not to pat ourselves on the back, not to interrupt you, but I don't want to speak arrogantly, but the part of the reason you and I get along so well, especially about subjects like this, is that we really do try. I mean, yes, we are, like you say, we vote blue and all that, but we really do try to get an all-encompassing worldview.
Yeah.
We try to see things from different perspectives.
This movie is not trying to see things from the opposite side. I mean, we talked about it before today. You have a whole genre, I mean, it's become a genre, of Holocaust movies where Nazis are painted with 17 different brushes. Layered, you know, you'll have a layered Nazi character, a character that you would think could be wholly evil, and they are given all these dimensions. They have all these different levels to their characters. They're not just painted as a cartoon villain. Now, we've talked about these KKK members with some sophistication, but they do have some kind of, they're painted in a bit broad strokes. You need to humanize them a little bit. So when I came away from this movie the first time, I didn't notice everything that Spike was doing because he was provoking me so much to be angry, which I think is a point of this movie. I didn't see a lot of that detail. A lot of that detail's there the second time, so I appreciate that now. I would still like to see it again. Like, this is a kind of movie.
Oh, I plan on seeing this.
This is a kind of movie, like,
without question,
in a way, it's like Zodiac. You know, it's so good as a procedural. The procedural's mixed in to a whole, the movie's far more than that, but you want that familiar detective story. I think that genre has a lot of rewatchability. This movie has surprisingly a ton of rewatchability. I just saw it again. I want to see it once more for sure.
I've only seen it the one time. I plan on seeing it again, though. The expectation I had, I certainly didn't expect what I got. To me, and this is what I said to you, to me, I walked away from this feeling like I had just been the guy, the main character, Malcolm McDowell, in The Clockwork Orange, when they hold his eyes open and they make him see all those images and stuff. And it's kind of presented in a very crass way. It's almost like you have these giant provocative pieces bookending this movie, and then in the middle you just happen to have a detective story.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's weird because I clung to the dark comedy, which is purposeful, the Jordan Peele Get Out stuff. I clung to the procedural parts of it, and I just like I'm rejecting or I'm afraid all the other stuff was rattling me so much, and you actually, you know.
So the complaints that you have are actually shared by Allison Wilkinson of Vox, in that it's too simplistic. People don't exist like these KKK members have been portrayed on screen, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know whether they do or not. I think they do. Yeah. I default to, I'm sure they do.
I said something to you before. We keep referencing that conversation. Yeah. We just had it on there.
Yeah,
but bottom line is, we don't know.
Right.
I'm not a psychologist, sociologist, psychiatrist.
And we're sheltered, too. I mean, we try to have a worldview, but we're very sheltered in this corner of the Northeast. Not saying that evils and ills of the world don't
exist. Are these races thoroughly evil? Are these races, they've gone down a path for so long that it's just, that level of evil just is all-consuming. And I'm sure we could talk about it as an argument of degree, and if you're if you believe in some relativism, or if you're very skeptical like I am.
But
I don't think anything is black or white.
We land on this point. Bad people exist.
Yes.
And there are bad people.
People who do terrible, horrible, evil shit exist.
Yes.
And that's never mind the sociopaths.
And those that are in the KKK, those that are openly voting and wanting white supremacy, are bad people.
It's gross.
Right.
What they've done over the years and the history being talked about in this film, never mind the rest of the world here.
So as far as expectations, I didn't know. Those are kind of where we landed. Production value, let's talk about it as a movie, though.
Yeah.
The sights. again, back to that Clockwork Orange thing, there are, at the beginning especially, there's colors and intensity and just in-your-face close-ups and anger just being thrown at you.
It's amazing how Spike Lee is doing a quote-unquote procedural through line in this story, right? It is very clearly he wants this to be true to the source material, and therefore the pacing for much of the movie is much slower in a Spike. And I knew this going in based on the pacing of the trailer. I was watching this, I'm like, wow, this is paced like Capote more than it is like Do the Right Thing. Do the Right Thing is like a mile a minute. The dialogue's right. Snapping. You got a ton of style along with the substance. This movie, you have sequences or short montages where Spike Lee shows all that style, all that talent that he's built a career upon. But this is Spike Lee really just giving to the narrative long stretches where I'm doing the procedural thing. And in terms of the site, I think you have the showy sequences where the cinematography is as good as we've seen all year. There's some shots in this movie that my favorite of this or maybe last year.
And to that, that's not really, I leaned over to you at one point during this. I'm like, this doesn't feel like a Spike Lee movie. Because the middle, yeah. The procedural, the police aspect of this really, I'm used to the Spike Lee of Do the Right Thing, where the message is there and it is right. Laid out in black and white and plain colors. But this is very showy and very cinematic. Again, I think this movie is genius, and that's kind of alluding to how I fall on it. I think it's genius in that everything was done with purpose. I think the KKK members are simplistic for a purpose. I think the idea that this wasn't so heavy on the message in the middle of the movie and kind of the most extreme layouts of the messages were at either end of the film was purposeful, because I think he wanted to give you a lot of meat on the bone to entertain you before he lulls you into telling you what you may not want to hear or see, but need to hear or see or take away from this movie.
Right.
I thought it was very effective filmmaking in that aspect.
He delivers goods for a dark comedy. He delivers right. goods for a crime drama.
Exactly.
He delivers goods for, what did I say, a dark comedy in the sense that it's a satiric look on that culture. But it's also kind of a period piece in many ways, because you have the dance sequence. You have
that was so bizarre,
student
that
union,
dance sequence.
The student union speech later on in the movie. You also have this movie. It's a comment on film history, which is one of the more fascinating takeaways for me. Spike has Gone with the Wind to open up the movie. Shot from Gone with the Wind. He has Shaft and Superfly and the blaxploitation films he lands both pro, or he lists both pros and cons with.
But they're
from
all,
the characters.
They're all purposefully done. The Gone with the Wind scene. Why is that? Why is the love for the Confederacy still so permeated and so permanent in our country?
Well, it's amazing that it builds up to such a crescendo with the Birth of a Nation stuff
right.
that you know from the trailers. And
I think that's the point he's making. Again, there's a big juxtaposition between black people viewing the world and white people viewing the world. And this, to me, again, this is a point I made. This is something I told Mike in our pre-production here. I think this movie was intended to explain how the world is viewed through a black lens. And obviously I say that with a bit of hesitation because I don't know for sure. It's just the message I was so clearly given.
It doesn't have to be that it's its sole purpose. It could be Spike Lee is doing that as well as 10 different things.
Right.
And I think you're right.
But
there.
he's explaining the lens through which, okay, white people are nostalgic. There's some white people that are nostalgic for the Confederacy. What did the Confederacy stand for? Well, this is the Confederacy, right? This is the white power, the Southern movement, these people that it's all stemmed in racism. Whereas black people have these blaxploitation films, they're talking about being martyrs. They just want their piece of the pie. They want their American dream that everyone else seems to be promised, but they've been under-delivered for. And I think that, again, I'm going to glow about this when we get the spoilers, but
yeah, we're going to break
everything
this
he was done yeah. was just so artistically and effectively done, yeah. and the message was great in this.
So I guess the next thing to talk about is editing. I would say editing is pretty masterful in this. I'll jump ahead.
How would this not get an edit?
I can't see how this doesn't get an editing. Never mind the versatility to do the procedural, but also to do the action sequence.
Right.
And then to parallel black power, white power sequences that, again, you've seen in the trailer, to have the showy dance sequence, to have the showy speech sequence.
The craziness at the beginning and end, and then with that in the middle, and have it
and
flow.
And still, the whole thing flows. Yeah. He understands pacing so well, Spike.
I agree.
This is a mature piece, because in the hands of a younger filmmaker, that this can't be done.
It's a mess.
It's a total tonal outpaced mess. Yeah. And he understands how to work.
Would it have even been considered a mess if this was his first film? If we didn't know,
I don't think he could have done this years ago. Yeah.
Well, not even years ago. I'm talking about Spike Lee now. If we didn't know what Do the Right Thing was, right? Yeah. If we didn't know his style of filmmaking with Summer of Sam, if we didn't know.
Look at Summer of Sam versus this movie. Summer of Sam goes off the rails. Oh, yeah. And it's almost like the momentum is too fast, where he can't say what he wants to say. That movie gets crazy.
Yeah.
Right?
But we know that Spike, my point is, we know that Spike is the auteur that hammers the message, right? Hammers the message in all scenes. If we didn't know that about him, would we have thought that this was just as much of a mess as anything else? I don't think so. I think this is coming across pretty clearly.
No, the clarity is there, but there's also, I mean, we talk about on the noseness, but when I see the sophistication of this story, because it's true, and also I think where he takes his license is to fit it to some kind of genre story beats, those are in there. And some moments of this movie, I guess to foreshadow what we're going to say about the script, it feels too placed. And that's my criticism of the script, my few criticisms of the script, is that I see the scaffolding and I see the notes just hit.
So you're
obviously
out on adapted screenplay with this.
I don't think at the end of the day that category is going to be open to it, because it's so loaded.
It is a loaded year for adapted. I agree with you, and especially, again, we just talked about how the Oscars are changing. They want this best big budget production, whatever, so they can basically weasel their way out of them being nominated for Best Picture. That's my take, not yours. I'm sorry. But they don't want to be polarizing. They want to be less polarizing. That's the take that I get from it. So obviously having something like this, glorifying it, where it's only going to speak to probably half the country, honestly, rightfully or wrongfully.
Well, yeah. I mean, by the numbers, half the country's relatively speaking, Democratic.
So
yeah.
I don't think this is going to... I agree with you for that. What about Best Director?
I think Best Director has a really good shot, I think the direction, the overall compositions, juggling so many balls in the air,
I
think that really fits. And editing and cinematography have a lot to do with the director's work there. So adapted screenplay, Spike is only a part of that. If it was just written by Spike Lee, maybe you would have the narrative to push him for an Oscar there. I think it's strong. I think it's going to be a top 10 adapted screenplay. But the holes in this movie are some notes that hit too hard in terms of those conventional scenes.
Any performances?
John David Washington
is great in this.
It works for this movie so well. Now, what I would question in terms of an Oscar lens is, does he have the Oscar reel scenes? Does he have that one scene to really sell the Academy on? I think he has to be nominated. Or does he just fit this character so well? Because this character is ice water in his veins, take a lot of shit. Here's the thing about his character that I loved. He's not Jackie Robinson. He gets that speech from the powers that be early on in the movie. He does not want to be Jackie
Robinson.
Doesn't
want to play nice.
He does not want to do that. So in a way, his role in this story, it works. And he understands his strengths and weaknesses enough to say, I better make sure to protect myself from losing my shit and losing my cool against these racist cops, racist KKK members. I better make sure I'm the guy behind the scenes in much of it. And when I am out there, I better make sure I have my armor up.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room, too. We said we could understand the issue last year when Sam Rockwell was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, that the argument was made by other people that it's not right to give him the recognition because you're glorifying a racist when you don't need to, when that option is out there.
Yeah.
Topher Grace plays David Duke. David Duke is a bad person. He's a terrible racist. I don't care what anyone wants to walk the line on. He's a bad person.
It's another character that doesn't, and a performance that doesn't have the showy scene.
I agree.
Here's the thing, like, this movie at its core, and the core storyline, is a crime procedural with disciplined individuals.
Well, here's
cops and
I want to make a David counter Dukes. Because we've said how these character the KKK members are simplistic, right? We've touched on that, and I think that's true, and I think that's purposeful. We'll get into it. Then you have David Duke come out, who's this laid back, personable for all intents and purposes. Yeah,
charismatic.
He's the only one on that side that's layered, and that's a point that you brought up actually, and it's one I agree with. Is that done in such a way that he doesn't need the showy scene? He's the one that he is the true embodiment of evil. Evil isn't when it's black and white. Evil is when it can come up to you, shake your hand, and convince you.
Exactly.
Right. So is that part of his performance? And if that's part of his performance, is that enough to consider him for a nomination of Best Supporting Actor?
It's stoic. I probably have to see it again and study it. I don't see it as of now.
I'm with you. For what it's worth, I agree with you.
I would say the same about Adam Driver. Just doesn't have that Oscar reel scene. The question at the end of the day is, you know, can somebody break down the nuances of a performance or a set of performances like this? And really, you know, put them on the level of, like last year we said, the stoic performances or the performances that weren't so loud from Saoirse Ronan in Lady Bird, from Manville in Phantom Thread, mm-hmm. you know, characters like that.
I can't, Leslie Manville.
I know.
You got Manville, though. That's
I got
Manville. You're good.
I got happening. Yeah. So John David Washington, I think he's up there right now in terms of my best actors, but I don't know. I think kind of to bring, we're all over the map right now with Oscar lens and production values. Yeah, that's fine. But I think the score, original score, has a real shot. I think the two obvious instances upon rewatch, or really the first time, that's that score. There's also another one that's wholly separate from the Temptation song. So yeah, the soundtrack should get recognized at the Grammys, I would say. Okay. Because the Grammys usually does that with, they do original sound, whatever. They have their own categories. Maybe we'll have to, you know, touch on some Grammys this coming
start
year.
Start a whole new Grammys pod and get into it. I get what you're saying. Yeah, go ahead.
The original score moments in this film fit so well.
They
and
do.
I know to the point where I noticed it and loved it in my first viewing.
They are very adept at putting you on edge and raising your ire. This is, again, speaking to the person that's probably in the middle of the road right now and they want you to get pissed off. It does a great job. It certainly pissed us off.
It helps the pacing of the movie, the way the melodies of those original scored songs, the way they flow.
I think if I were to rank it just to tie in original score or tie in production with the Oscar lens, editing and director to me are the two that seem to be musts. Editing more so than director even, but director again because it's just a unique thing.
Right.
Score would be in the second tier. Any performances I think I would have below score as well.
Yeah, I think this is going to have a hard time in terms of performances, as good as they are, and as well as they fit, and as strong as the overall ensemble is. Perhaps something like at the SAG Awards, the Ensemble Awards, awards.
Which, by the way, if we're adding Oscars, that should be an added category. But never mind.
Very good. We're gonna talk about how we can fix the Oscars in a pod later on this week. But we have a lot of categories where this film should be a contender, right? It should be a top 10
and
in a lot of categories.
I think that's enough for the message of the film.
Yeah.
This needs to stay relevant because it should be seen by a wider audience. It probably won't be because there are people that are just going to be turned off by the subject matter and shut down immediately, but this needs to stay relevant because it is relevant.
So finally, Mike, Best Picture in terms of an Oscar lens. It has a grade, we'll talk about it in spoilers, from me and I think from you as well, that's going to be high enough to compare it to other Best Picture winners. So in terms of our curve, our grading curve, it's going to fit the profile of a Best Picture contender. Is it going to be one of our top 10 films of the year? I don't know.
Are you bringing the casual viewers back to the Oscars if you're nominating Black Klansman for Best Picture? Is my question. If the whole point of the biggest production, the new Oscar category, is to bring casual viewers back and make it less political, you're not doing that if you're nominating this for Best Picture.
I know. I know the narratives take hold. I would just like, you know, can you vote the top 10 movies of the year?
I'm with you, man. This is one of them question.
Can you just, Academy, can you just say, these are the top 10 movies of the year? God damn it.
You simple-minded fool.
Put them up there.
You simple-minded, rose-colored man.
And if so, then this movie is a major contender.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's worthy, certainly. It's going to be a question of what are we doing? What are we doing, Oscars? What are we doing, Academy? Why did you invite all these new people and then worry about the casual viewers that aren't going to come back anyway? It's a very interesting look forward is what we're doing, and we're going to cover all of it. Let's dance for now.
Let's dance.
Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
This is the spoiler section for Black Klansman. That's why you heard the big spoiler dance party breakdown that just played. It's probably time to get a new one, right? I gotta record something new. Get my DJ muscles flexing again. But
you want to change greatness? I mean, you're pretty great right there.
I don't know. Maybe you're right. I am perfect. this is all spoilers for the Black Klansman movie, Spike Lee's newest movie. So if you have not seen the movie yet, if you don't want to know what happens at the twists and turns or with the plot, go back, see the movie, hit pause here, come back after you've seen the movie and hit play. But if you want to know what happens, if you've seen what happens, you want to hear our take on it. It's all about the twists and turns from here on out. So Black Klansman spoilers from this point forward as we go. Do we have any carryovers or we just want to do plot?
I got a couple, Mike, okay. Carryovers. Number one, Alec Baldwin Wynn was that cameo.
Yeah, he gives himself a name, which I thought was an interesting touch.
Beauregard.
Yeah, what it's listed here. It's Dr. Kennebrew Beauregard. I don't think that's a real person.
I don't know. Bottom line is that Alec Baldwin, the guy who plays on a parody, Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, week to week. I don't think it's an accident that Alec Baldwin's being used here.
I agree on that point, as far as he's obviously very political already. I also agree, I tweeted this a couple weeks ago, when you have a short, succinct speech that you need to deliver with impact and the highest force and the highest velocity to get it out there, Alec Baldwin's the master.
Well, here's what's so crazy about this speech, too. It's chilling and terrifying, right? Because of its substance. And yet, we're laughing throughout it because it's showing all the bloopers.
Yep.
It's showing all the flubs, all the audio that we have to edit out. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. In our podcasts, whatever he's saying there, it's funny.
Yeah, you're right, but it's also more terrifying because hate could have that many takes. Hatred is just as vitriolistic once you have to cut and go back to a different take. And now it's presented in a way that maybe he's doing a voiceover for something like Voice of a Nation, you know, one of those type of propaganda films as well. It's very funny, personable, because we all screw up, but also very, very chilling in both its message and its meta delivery.
So the two other carryovers, I would say, the Kwame Ture speech, and then later on in the film, the Black Power, White Power buildup. Mm-hmm. I just want to talk about the cinematography and the editing of those two really quick. The shots of, with the black, matte black background, the shots of the faces, the big blow-ups of the faces, I think that's so unique, and it's something I haven't really seen from Spike movies quite yet. That's something so stylistic, and yet it's innovative from Spike. I don't know. People correct me if I'm wrong, if he's used that technique in another movie or that style of shot in another movie. To actually give that quote-unquote collage of three or four faces, those close-ups, right, while Corey Hawkins is delivering that speech was so fascinating to me. It actionized,
very cinematic. It made the message.
Yeah, this is so important.
It showed the impact of the message.
Other directors will just have a person give a speech and they won't make it cinematic.
Deity and deifying speeches is kind of a big theme throughout this, and not literally religious, but sometimes literally religious. And they're all given those low angle upshots at putting the speaker at kind of a higher platform, and it's used for different purposes. And it's juxtaposed against when it's used for the black speaker versus the white speaker. And I think, again, that's done purposefully.
Yeah.
We'll get into that as we go. But you're right. It was a very unique and very effective method.
He lingers on just the straight up speech for a while to get Corey Hawkins' performance through. And his performance is phenomenal there. It is a powerful speech. It gets you riled up. It gets you inspired. However, he just won't let it stay there. He makes it thoroughly cinematic.
Yeah.
And some of the showier stuff in the movie is during the most theatrical scenes in the script. And I thought that's brilliant. And it's just so Spike Lee.
He's got a future in this business.
He might. So cinematography and editing for those sequences alone. Obviously, when you have just an old man in front of a group of college kids telling a story.
Oh, my God.
Right?
That's my best scene, by the way. That back and forth between black power, white power.
That
my best
sequence
scene.
There, the editing of that together, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes and what that means and what we think it means. And I think your thesis statement really pays off there. The bottom line to me is, you don't, for my money, the directing job Spike Lee does throughout that sequence is as good as anything we've seen last couple of years.
And it's also, there's the subtext of the commentary that it is, because you'll see on Fox News on a nightly basis that these groups have what on the surface looks like the same message. But the subtext and the backstory and the history is what I think is what Spike was showing, but it's not. It's not at all. Black Lives Matter is not the same message as white lives or all lives matter. It's not.
Right.
And I think that's what he was getting. And like you said, I have a whole spiel about that. We'll get into it.
And yet, I still think he's charitable in terms of giving some dimensions to the racist characters. I do think he is. I've noticed it upon rewatch.
Okay, so it's going into that a little bit.
It's not just a snarling cartoon, the twisting of the mustached villain, right? There's the scenes that get closest to that, in my mind, are my worst scenes of the movie. However, start the film, you have the Gone with the Wind, the epic shot there, showing mass death and injury for the Confederate Army on the railroad tracks.
And if you don't know Gone with the Wind, you wouldn't know that was the Confederate Army, really, until the pullback shows the flag. You're just supposed to feel sympathy for soldiers in battle that are injured. And then the camera keeps pulling back, and you see the Confederate Army.
So you're seeing in the wake of that suffering comes this hate group, right?
Right.
So and he makes that very clear from one to the other, from Gone with the Wind, Army defeated, mass amounts of suffering, to Alec Baldwin, hate speech, eugenics, nightmare, in terms of where that can go, in terms of a reaction to that.
And in the Gone with the Wind scene, it's all the Confederate Army, and then the Alec Baldwin scene comes, and he talks about the Jewish-controlled Supreme Court, the Jewish-controlled Hollywood. And the Jews throughout this, the Jewish people, are kind of like a secondary target of the hate for the KKK. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, the black people and the black plight and racism in that aspect is kind of the main overlay, but there is a lot of focus also on the Jewish and persecution for faith.
Absolutely. It's tied into the last scene of the film with the Charlottesville Jews will not replace us line still being, chanted at these friggin' rallies and these marches. So, yes, it's definitely involved. In terms of the progression of scenes, Spike, it's obvious, but it's also, it makes so much sense on the overall, because he goes from one to the other. He goes from ruins of the Confederacy to hate speech. And it's crazy how they delve into the history of 100 years ago to justify what they're doing today. And it's the same way later on in the film Birth of a Nation, that film still holds resonance
to
what they're doing.
There's so many winks to, like, and it's such a look in the mirror of, like, what the fuck are we doing as a country? That speech that John Stallworth has with a white detective who's saying that, well, if you wanted to implement hate into American society, you don't do it outwardly. You don't do it from a rage perspective. You do it what David Duke's doing. You do it through policy. You do it through politicians and seeping it in, and how essentially one day we're going to elect Trump.
Yeah. So now In any other movie, we'd call that heavy-handed. Of course. I think it is heavy-handed. And I think it is
obvious. I think this movie is heavy-handed.
So we've had a problem with that with other movies. So I don't want to be hypocritical myself because I have crushed other movies for being so obvious when he talks about making America first. And I wonder if it was said. The bottom line, I think, in terms of this plot line is a lot of it I want to see for myself. I want to read the book. I'm going to listen to the book.
I am willing to be a hypocrite and say that it was very effective.
It's effective,
and
yeah.
And I thought it was actually genius to include because the movie is so heavy-handed. Let's do the plot first, and then we'll get into the ins and outs of it.
Act one is essentially Ron Stallworth becoming the first black police officer in Colorado Springs PD, working in the records room after a really awesome scene between him and the chief and Isaiah Whitlock there. I don't remember what his role is, if he's an alderman, a councilman, or if he's just on the board or whatever.
I don't remember. He might be the mayor. But yeah, he's an important decision maker.
They're talking about that he has to be the Jackie Robinson of their police department.
Got
to
turn the other cheek.
Yeah, you got to turn the other cheek. And you could see John David Washington, you could see Ron Stallworth kind of breathing heavy.
Grit through his teeth.
He's not going to do that. In Act One, he's that willful protagonist you need because, again, he's not going to do that. He's not just going to sit back and take the shit and be passive. He's going to give it back. And he needs to constructively hone that rage, which he will do based on what Act One throws into Act Two.
Pacifism being viewed as a negative is actually a kind of a theme, running theme throughout the movie, too. Because not only does he stand up for black people, the first chance he gets from the toad scene. I got no toads here.
Yeah.
He also, towards the end of the movie, when he's having a talk about the bad cop, the bad racist cop, and he's saying, why do you guys all just stand by and do it? And the explanation he's given is that brotherhood, you don't snitch on one another. You have each other's back. And he makes the parallel of the cops being the same line of thinking as the KKK.
I think it's so fascinating, Spike Lee's relationship to violence in his movies throughout his career. In this movie, it still feels like moral wrong. It still feels like when Corey Hawkins in Act One there, because essentially Ron Stallworth is made to spy on his own people by the Colorado right. Springs PD. And it inspires him instead of turns him against his own right. people, instead of him really working for them. And it's amazing that he finds camaraderie and friends in the PD when they agree with him that these people are not going to cause others harm, that in many ways it's just posturing what they're saying up there. And Corey Hawkins has said things that would incite violence. And yet Ron Stallworth, the character, takes the meaning behind, takes what's good from that speech and he applies it right to that inciting incident in Act Two, which is brilliant. Seeing the KKK ad, correct, in the newspaper, calling that, making that first phone call. So he basically takes all that rage and he channels it towards something good to do on behalf of his people.
He also explained away the Kwame speech and saying, and I thought this was fascinating too, he's basically our conduit for the movie. And he's who we are seeing this movie through. And also he explains away to the chief, well, yeah, you know, Kwame said some radical things, but I don't think he was serious about any of them. That was just kind of blowing off smoke. And
talk and then there's violence to come back to my original point.
And it's kind of like we need that explained to us sometimes because we all have different perspectives. We all come from different areas of life. And if we see a black person talking about army and getting ready for the race war, I'm going to be fearful if I see that. But obviously they see it as not so serious and it's not what is being said.
These guys, all these undercover cops, by the way, ice water in the veins.
Oh, yeah.
I thought the performances really displayed that. And they're nuanced performances more than they are showy performances on that regard. So Stallworth is stuck in the records room until he basically comes into the office of the chief and says, make me undercover. They do make him undercover. And so after he gets out of that scenario. They put him in the intelligence department with all those same guys that he worked with. He goes and he sees the Kwame Ture speech, gets out of there, is inspired to make that phone call for the KKK, and immediately, with all the hate speech that he says to the KKK, chapter president or
which
whatever,
which is portrayed as a funny moment.
Yeah, it's the key to the trailer, which I thought is, and again, that's great marketing.
Right.
It's a mark of a really strong script to be able to sell your film on just like a more of a scene in its
in
talking its whole.
About how he only has love for purebred white America.
So he's doing a little bit of a sorry to bother you white voice there, which I think really works in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, it's not very far from his voice in this movie.
No, it's not.
Even though you hear Denzel every time he laughs. But he does make the mistake of giving his real name to the Klan.
Which is also turned into a joke, yeah.
Yeah, so he's a rookie. So the funniest scenes of the movie, I won't give away those punchlines again, is when he's with the sergeant, they're talking about how ridiculous this mission you want to create is, and yet he still sells the sergeant and then the chief on what he wants to do on the white Ron Stallworth that he needs. Adam Driver's his man there. So that's fascinating that you basically, for Act Two, you have Adam Driver getting deeper into the KKK as the real life
in person Ron Stallworth,
and then you have Ron Stallworth getting deeper into the KKK with David Duke over the phone. I thought that's fascinating, and you get the different levels of that organization. Literally, what's also fascinating is you still have the thread where Ron Stallworth has a relationship with the Patrice Dumas character, Laura Harrier there, and the Black Student Union. I think that's a very important B story to collide in a huge way at the end of Act 2 there.
Well, it gives you your main conflict. Yeah, it gives you the biggest conflict and conflict resolution of the movie, certainly.
So,
at least of the detective portion of the movie.
No, it's essential. And you wouldn't think that inane conversations about Shaft and Superfly would build up right from Act 2 to the end where you got a full-blown
terrorist attack.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take 17. Okay. So as Adam Driver gets deeper in with the KKK, he is fooling most of them. Most of them he's endearing himself to. Felix Kendrickson, whose wife is Connie, this guy with the goatee, and is not buying him. He takes him in the back, and there's a major scare when a crazy scene where he wants to make him to take a lie detector test. He wants to see his dick, to see if he's circumcised.
Yeah.
He wants a whole bunch of things. Obviously, the real Ron Stallworth hears this over the phone, throws the thing through the window. That's crazy. But it's amazing how Adam Driver also saves Ron in that scene because he grabs the gun away. And then he shoots purposefully.
Yeah, Felix is trying to gun down the real Ron Stallworth, who just threw a brick through the window.
Not that far
to interrupt.
Away. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, and he's trying to shoot him down, and Adam Driver grabs the gun out of his hand
and shoots off
on the driveway instead. And then, I mean, and Adam Driver, beautifully in that scene, he turns that around on Felix and says, "Do you still want me to take your stupid lie detector test?" With the subtext being, "I just fired all these bullets at this black guy that ran away."
Right. I think where this movie gets its most clever, and where I think it has more depth than meets the eye, is how it's talking about institutions, how it's talking about the institution of the Colorado Springs Police Department, how it's talking about the institution of the FBI. It's still a little elusive to me, you know, in terms they have people that work for NORAD involved in the KKK, and you have the FBI.
Purposeful,
with
man. I mean,
their
it's,
hands
it,
on the pulse
it's,
of this.
It's to me, it was Spike talking about how this issue pervades everything. I mean, obviously you can't make a movie about how deep it goes into every aspect, but it touches on town administrations, it touches on police departments, the FBI, NORAD. It's what do you call it? This movie is, what is it? What's the phrase? Lake wide, but river deep?
Yeah, river wide there.
Yeah, I mean, it touches on a bunch of different things, but it goes into this one particular aspect.
So the KKK is enraged after this incident. Felix basically accelerates his plan, or at least he goes down the road with this plan to kill, on his wife's suggestion, kill the Black Student Union president, who was publicized.
Got her name in the paper a bunch after talking bad about the police.
After a police pulled her over before she had, quote unquote, a date with Ron.
And Ron and her dating without the real Ron having revealed yet that he is, in fact, a cop or a policeman, and she thinks all cops are pigs, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. That's a fascinating progression with her character, racist cop pulled her over, very particular racist cop who also gave Ron trouble in the records right. room there. That's going to have a act one beat, an act two beat, and then of course an act three beat later on. It's a crazy sequence where Ron Stallworth is made David Duke's bodyguard. And the sequence lasts for maybe 45 minutes.
I still
minutes,
don't know what the purpose of that is. I don't know why that was done.
Do you buy that as having really happened? I think it must have, right? It's such a huge story beat. So it's such a huge part story arc, never mind beat.
I don't know. I don't. I
got to read the book.
I don't know. My guess is as good as anyone else's, but I don't know if it didn't, what the purpose of that was that the chief put him. I mean, the explanation given is that Ron's the only available person to work that detail.
Do they want to sabotage
him? Exactly. I don't know if the chief wants him on the inside to further his investigation. I don't know if the chief wants him to sabotage the investigation.
I think it must have been more complex than that, because to have Ron there, knowing what he knows about the KKK, having infiltrated them for the last however
many
months.
Maybe he wanted them to have Adam Driver's back,
yeah,
because there were so many KKK members.
That makes some sense. Yeah. To have his knowledgeable detective there.
Still working my way through that mentally. I'm not positive. But yes, he does end up working the security detail personally for David Duke. And David Duke, upon meeting him, is very nice to him and very kind of personable and not as much conflict, head-to-head confliction as you think there would be.
In terms of screenwriting principles, they talk in many ways about triangulating the conflict. You don't want to have your protagonist working through a scene or a sequence without conflict coming upon them in multiple directions. So you have Ron Stallworth, you have the good guys in the scene, they're getting it from multiple directions. You have Adam Driver he's conflicted himself about realizing his Jewish heritage and his Judaism. He's realizing who he is for the first time in his life. This, like he said in the previous monologue, I'm thinking, now this is all I can think about. I never thought about it my rest of my life combined.
I was happy just being a white person.
You can see the looks he gives David Duke after he's being inaugurated in that ceremony for the KKK. You could see his inner conflict there. He's also being found out by Felix, and he's also looking out for Ron, the real Ron Stallworth, who's in the room, and they're also trying to uncover this plot to bomb the Black Student Union, which of course they're sitting out for, or they're basically protecting so that these people would have to resort to Plan B, but they don't know there's a Plan B.
Right.
They kind of think there's a Plan A.
Taken up by Felix on his own accord, really.
And then Ron has that triangulated conflict where he's dealing with the racist room. He's sneaking around to see the ceremonies that he's not supposed to see. Right. He's watching the screening of Birth of a Nation there. And then, of course, again, he's trying to figure out the conflict, uncover the plot that Felix is going to bomb.
Bombing, yeah.
And when they leave, he's breaking rank and leaving to go chase it down.
Yep.
So Plan B is to just kill the student union president and whoever she's with, because they couldn't blow up the whole student union meeting. Now, it's crazy because it's kind of fortunate. I think Spike Lee purposefully, and I think it must be true, if the C4 didn't fit in the mailbox in the movie, it probably didn't fit in the real life story of it. So I think Spike Lee is purposely saying they're lucky. They're not just good here, but they got lucky that this C4 didn't fit in that gosh darn house. So one of the more ironically, I guess, horrifying movements of this story, Ron gets there. He arrests Connie.
You get the alternate ending to get out.
Yeah, he arrests Connie. The cops see him arresting Connie, the wife of the KKK.
I mean, this is
member.
Exactly what we all thought about Get Out, except that in Get Out, it was Lil Rel and the TSA car. In this instance, it's the cops, the white cops, coming up on a black man mounted a white woman and beat the shit
out of Ron.
Yep.
Which is disgusting, just nauseating.
Horrible.
And he's just taking a beating while the fruits of these dumb KKK members' actions come to bear. And I think Spike Lee is doing this purposeful. I would be upset if the truth of the story is that Ron Stallworth was the heroic force in this final act, this final scene, and they ignored that, because I think that's important to honor that story. But if this was, again, lucky, then they were lucky, then that's horrifying.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother element to this
sequence. Right.
And to this true story.
And they do end up lucky because the bomb does go off. Car. And it turns out that she, instead of putting it in the mailbox, put it next to the car, which is where Felix pulls up to. So Felix actually gets blown up in his car
So that when the KKK guys get there to detonate it.
Right.
It's right next to the car. Now, of course, Flip gets there. The secret Ron Stallworth gets there. Adam Driver's
character, yeah.
And he gets the cops off of the real Ron. And we have an epilogue or a resolution that goes for a couple beats. And I think this is one of the stronger finishes of a movie
in a while.
And
it's funny because I thought this is going too long. Why isn't this movie ended?
Yeah, why are we lingering?
Right. And we're lingering because Spike Lee has so much more to say in such a truncated period.
So you have the scene at the police station where they're celebrating. He's walking in. He's feeling himself. He's loving
life. Oh, yeah. He's
life.
On cloud nine. He's
they're all
it.
Congratulating one another because their mission succeeded so well. So Ron gets there, and then the sergeant, the four main guys get called into the chief's office. The chief says, mission's over. Destroy all evidence.
Yes.
So that tells you a lot about the institutional control and
systemic
about
systemic issues, yeah.
You know, what their motivation is or how far they're willing to go to do the right thing and how far they're not willing to stick their neck out for. So that's alarming. Obviously, you have Ron Stallworth, the real Ron Stallworth, disobeying that order, which we're all happy about today. Now you have the next sequence is seemingly all the key characters at the bar celebrating, right? One of my worst scenes of the film, I have two, but this is one of them. It felt like an added on, put a bow on it kind of a scene where they also happen to get the white racist cop who has a beat in Act 1 and Act 2 as being a white racist cop. Maybe two beats in Act 2.
They arrest him for admitting basically that he went beyond his duties as a police officer and stopping the car with Kwame in the first act. My counter to that, I know what you said is your worst scene. My counter to that is that having passivity be viewed as such a negative and the antithesis of a movement and how you can't just be a passive bystander. And I think that's one of the messages that Spike Lee hammers throughout this film. I think that was just kind of a cherry thrown. Like, look what happens if you put in the least amount of effort. If you're in this position, if you're in the position of a police department and you put in just a minimal amount of effort, you can catch a bad guy that doesn't belong to being a cop.
It just feels like, here's the thing. It just feels like in the structure of the sequence, it feels contrived and it feels like movie shit. Like, all right, we're having a celebration and we also get this asshole.
See, I think they need, but the next scene is a cross burn. I think that's where,
again, when you consider the overall arc of the narrative, sometimes you can forgive, and which I do. Right. I can forgive those scenes having to be what they were, because you needed that momentum of good feeling to go a little longer, even though you got the sinking feel of the case being shut down. You need that momentum go a little longer because then you have the knock on his door as Patrice is breaking up with him.
Right.
Which I don't think is
she
an accident.
She can't be with a cop, yeah.
I don't think that's an accident. So you already, again, you're triangulating conflict. She's breaking up with him. You think it's going to be a happily ever after, but you're getting it foreshadowed that it's not because you get the most, in my opinion, trademark Spike Lee shots.
1,000%.
I don't know what you call it, but it's basically you put the characters on something that moves, and you roll them while you also track the camera back, and it's just amazing effect on what you see. They have their guns out. They go to the window. There's a burning cross. Then you get the Charlottesville addendum,
right? And the Charlottesville addendum is basically a mini documentary about what happened 364 days ago. With the Charlottesville riot, and it's Heather Heyer is the young woman who lost her life that day. And Spike Lee went to her family and asked if he could use her image and her likeness at the end of his film, and they agreed. And so that's basically the movie is dedicated in her honor. So that's the plot. Again, bookended by two things that are not at all really to do, quote unquote, substantively with the plot of the movie, but have big impacts and big messages about what the movie stands for. I said my best scene was the black power, white power dueling montage. Here's my thoughts on that.
Right.
I think it was very effective because it is kind of the crux of the movie, and it's what Spike Lee wanted to do in showing this movie. This movie, again, I don't think it was for anyone but white people. I think it was a black man who was very seeped in the political world, who knows, is very in tune with the Black Lives Matter movement, who's very in tune with all the racial oppression. He wanted to show middle of the road white people.
Yeah, I think that's, it's one of his,
I know what you're saying, that, but I think this scene in particular was that. Well, I think he wanted to show people like us who may get misguided and may not know that there's a difference between Black Lives Matter and White Lives Matter. The Black Lives Matter movement, the black movement, the Black Power movement was about a suppressed group of people wanting their piece.
Equality. It's about equality.
The White Power movement, the All Lives Matter, the you're not more important than us
superiority
movement, it's about oppression and being the oppressor and keeping people down. And that's why the David Duke scene is shot in a fucking church, whereas the Black Power scene, that's why the Black Power story is being told in this basically this frat house, this student union house where everyone's close together and they're just hanging out and they want their piece of the American dream. And the American dream in their eyes is just to live without being bothered and without live rightfully. And that's why the story is told about the black lynching that took place of this young man who was accused of these awful, horrendous crimes after an hour jury deliberation. He's hung and lynched and dipped in fire in the middle of town. And
nightmare.
People,
just
white people are there in their Sunday's best. This is their entertainment for the weekend.
This movie will piss you off.
Yeah, and it did piss me off. That's the duality of this scene. It's
nightmare.
Showing you, again, whether or not it's made for white people, that's my take, but it's showing you the differences in the origins between black power and white power, between Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter.
I think the narrative, and I think obviously the editing of it all together, is sophisticated to the sense that you have this false equivalency at the end of that sequence. You have the Klan doing their cheerleading
thing. It looks like
thing,
the same thing on
watching
the
Birth of a Nation, just happy that they lynched right. the character at the end of Birth of a Nation. You follow a lot of the plot of the Birth of a Nation there.
Yeah.
More than we would want to. And I remember that movie's just gross anyway. It's disgusting to me how it's still touted as what it is. It's fucking,
but that's the point, Mike. Yeah. Like that's it's disgusting
point.
How all this shit
but
is still
when
touted.
When you have the white power chant and the black power chant meeting at the climax of that whole sequence, that I think that's Spike telling you how the look of it
a
at the end of the day
a thousand
is the
percent.
Same.
And that's why I say it's meant for middle of the road white people, because right. black people know that story. Right? I mean, black people know what they mean when they say black power. White people may not know what black people mean when they say black people sure as shit know what white people say when they say white power.
Yeah.
But middle of the road, everyday white people may not know what black power means. It was to show the origins of those, of the angst, of the inequality, of why it matters. Because you're right. That's the whole point. To the ear, black power and white power are the same message.
And
they are
yet,
so not the same message.
And I think Spike is being critical to a degree of Black power, the Black Power movement, because he builds it up to that false equivalency, and his hero of the story is in the middle. His hero of the story is at that paradox. He's working for the institution. He's working to change the system from the inside.
Yeah,
I think.
But how do you think that's him being critical of that?
Well, I think by. I don't think Spike's ever shied away from being critical of his own people from Do the Right Thing all the way till now. I think he's shown many dimensions to his characters. He's shown many of his characters saying fucked up things and all of his quote unquote, you know, just spouts of racism.
I don't disagree.
Like in 25th Hour, he's got every race in New York having that hate speech montage involved in, I think there's something like that in Do the Right Thing, but it's definitely in 25th Hour and in later movies where Spike's trying to show everybody's humanity, everybody does fucked up things.
Yeah.
So in this scene, to have the KKK sequence build up in a totally different kind of build than what happens with the Black Power, the Com student union meeting, and yet it's the same look at the end of it. I think Spike's saying, based on what Corey Hawkins said at the end of that meeting, why are we ending? This is a bad look. This is a bad fucking
that's
look.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's
and
a
I
good
think
point.
I think Spike is saying that in this sequence because at the
that's
end.
That's interesting. It's not something I thought of.
Well, that's something he wrestled with in the Malcolm X movie. Because Malcolm X winds up being such a pacifist at the end of that movie, and Spike thoroughly talks about that. And yet the look of that movement and that in that epic movie that Spike has been wrestling with, I think brings me back to my point before, what he thinks of violence and what he thinks of just talk. And I think he shows a lot of people to be talking shit rather than doing
but
shit. And there's a big difference. What I'm saying
to.
Is Spike in moving that sequence the way he does, he's showing that the derivation of the white chant and the derivation of the black power chant and the white power chant are totally different.
Yeah.
One's telling a story about, like you said, persecution and being thoroughly oppressed.
Yeah.
And you have a heartwarming story that's meant to inspire folks. And yet the white power obviously is showing Birth of a Nation, which is a racist film, and it's all about just stepping on the necks of the oppressed.
Right.
So it's totally different, those two sequences. One's just about, you know, manipulating a group or basically just pumping them up with hot air that they're powerful, correct?
Yeah.
They're still powerful. It's manipulation. And essentially, when you end with the same chant from two different sides, it's, in my mind, Spike is saying it is a false equivalency. It is misunderstanding.
False being the operative words. Yeah.
It's a misunderstanding at the end of the day.
It's not something I thought of. I think I makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Man, is this a fucking powder keg of a movie or what? Jesus Christ.
It's intense.
So, where do we go from here? What do we do?
I think we finish it up.
How do we end racism?
where I was at this time, arguing with Trump supporters, trying to find common ground, I saw the movie at the wrong time for me. And then a couple days later, I got hyped up more. But this is a movie where you're preaching to the choir in many ways. And you're preaching to both sides of the choir,
in my mind.
Well,
let's talk about that for a second, because Trump supporters aren't going to see this movie.
Yeah, you're making this movie for Democrats, whether you're making it for a white audience or a black audience, I don't know. I think both. But
I think it's for both, but you're right. I don't disagree. I think it is for both. I think there's parts that speak more to one side or the other because it's supposed to be educational and informative.
You're not reaching an olive branch across the aisle with this movie at all.
I don't think, and that's why I'm surprised, that 78% audience score, those kind of lower marks, I think anyone that sees the world in that way, that's seeing this already, is going to love it and think it's a great movie like we do.
Right.
I think that you're not going to change any opinions of people on the right. But maybe that's the point. Maybe you're not ever going to change their opinion.
Spike talked about he wanted this movie to inspire people to vote. He's talked about it throughout
the movie. And he knows he's not going to get the ardent Trump supporters anyway. So maybe that makes sense. Maybe that's what he was doing. I do think everything he did in this movie did have a purpose.
However, as we said, the criticism that I've heard from many people about the Academy, about the Oscars, about Hollywood in general, is that you have these movies that are not meant, they're not reaching across the aisle at all. And if Oscar night is just celebrating these movies, then Republicans aren't going to watch it, and that's the whole problem with the ratings.
Yeah, but you know what? Maybe it's time for those hardcore supporters to be put in their place too, because first of all, if you're in the extreme of any issue, you're not right. The truth is always somewhere in the middle, but if you're a hardcore, you know, I can't watch these movies because of their messages and their political messages. Wake up, man. Politics are everywhere now. Politics is pop culture. I said it in our last episode. This shit matters. Like, you can't just close your eyes and be naive to it. And you can't, you are the type that's...
Their argument at the end of the day is this shit is biased. And I don't necessarily think he guards himself from bias. He accepts that it's bias, and he doesn't try to hide that fact.
Yeah, but maybe he's fighting bias with bias. Like, okay, you have Fox News, and you have Hannity, and you have all the bullshit Trump stuff. So here's
I'm
some
not
stuff.
Saying he's wrong. Yeah, I support it, and I believe in it, what he's saying. It's just the fact that, to my expectations, I saw this at a place where I'd just been arguing with the same Trump supporter for the last couple of weeks. We keep getting these.
You're not going to change those people.
I disagree, but I think you can.
Goddamn ideologue, and you're so nice, and you have such a pure heart, and I'm just a miserable fuck.
I think let's get into final worst scene, because we had one more, and then we'll wrap this thing up. The scene where the Kendricksons are having pillow talk, where Connie and Felix Kendrickson, we've always talked about killing them. And then they have like the fucking cult follower eyes where they don't blink the whole scene. They're just staring off into just this
lunacy.
Mental illness, lunacy scene. They might as well have been twirling their mustaches in that.
But
as
isn't
villains.
That the point? I know you feel that way, but isn't that the point that like, yes, it is lunacy from quote unquote an objective point of view, but this shit, I know you don't think it's out there. I do think it's out there.
Well, I think it becomes it. Obviously, when you have these evil acts, they're holy evil acts, it becomes that. And they get so diluted, these folks. But again, I'm not a psychologist, psychiatrist, or sociologist.
I know.
We've seen a whole genre, and it typically doesn't work in film when you have that mustache twirling villain. It just doesn't work. You need more dimensions for that. And those two characters, in my opinion, yeah. Well, here's the thing, though. Connie had some sympathy built in the way Felix kind of throws her out of the meeting and back in the kitchen.
Right, exactly.
You get some sympathy for her. And Spike does that with these characters. You have the Breachway character, who's kind of the one that keeps putting Felix at arm's length.
Right.
So you kind of like, in a weird way, you like him a little bit because he's helping Adam Driver. Well,
that would be my counter argument is that these evil comes in many forms, and these, like you said, the id, ego, and superego of those three,
those characters as a composite.
Yeah, they're like the evolution of hatred.
Represent different levels. So you said the evolution of man. That was brilliant.
Yeah. On one side you have Felix, who's like all snarling and evil and hate everyone, and then on the other end of the spectrum is David Duke, who's the devil in disguise.
And then you have that other character who's making the C form, who's hijacking it from the army base, who's basically a sociopath, who's basically saying, all right, here's the C4, let's make a bomb, let's kill them.
Your problem seems to be that Felix is like a cartoon character.
But we have a lot of screen time dedicated to Felix's character. So it's you have one scene after another, but the character doesn't necessarily have an arc. He's a racist nightmare from the moment we meet him to the moment he gets blown up. He's a force of nature like the Dunkirk Nazis that you never see in that movie.
I don't think anything you said is wrong. I think, again, it was purposely done to paint him with that wide brush because I think the point is that while evil comes in varying cloaks and varying suits and varying degrees, the most obvious evil is just as surreptitiously menacing and capable of awfulness as the evil of that'll shake your hand and wants to get into the institution of government. I think that was his point, that all these guys are on this evolution of man scale, this evolution of evil scale, but they're all working towards the common goal of doing some despicable shit.
So what I'm trying to break down is Felix's character. He's been fooled. He's been,
he's a simpleton.
He's been fooled so many times, and he's also not well liked within his group of Klansmen. He will, to the point where he won't become the leader. He has to basically...
Yeah, but not well liked is because he has followers that help him with the bomb stuff,
That he has a connection, and then he has one follower, which is the dumbest one in the group,
right.
The Sean from I, Tonya character. So I think Spike is trying to paint him with a brush that this... He's given him some levels of empathy, even if they're minute and microscopic.
Okay.
It is there. But I just think when you have an arc that large in the story, that plays that large in the story, it's hard to write them with one brush.
I think it's purposeful. I think it was all done. I think these guys are all the one notes that they are throughout the movie. Because you're right. There is no really characterization. They don't really change at all.
Yeah.
What as they are presented is what they are. And I think that was purpose. I think the point of it is it comes in many forms.
In other movies, that's handled differently, like I said, with Dunkirk, though. You know, when you have characters that you're not going to characterize, you know, just leave him in the background or leave him as menacing.
It's so meta.
It's hard.
Everything about this is so meta.
Criticize Spike Lee. So great.
Right.
But that is a legitimate criticism. I guess we finished with final grades, though.
It's anywhere from a 4 to a 900. Yeah, no, let's do final grades. What did you have?
I have this movie above Shape of Water last year. I have it as a B+ 89 at the end of the day here. It's one of those movies that I want to see again. Maybe I'll figure out more of those distinctions and what Spike is doing. Cause upon rewatch, I was able to see more. So what I'm curious about is if he's making it seem obvious in one regard, but there's more to it. As you dissect it, and I won't put that past
and
Spike Lee.
It's with that point that there's more to it that I graded this on. It's actually the rare movie I have higher than you. I'm a 90 A-. I think there is more to it, and I think you're going to get more out of it each viewing, and I think that's the point. I think the overall point, though, is to keep it relevant. I think this is a movie that should be shared and seen.
Right.
And I hope we did a respectable job, at least, in analyzing it and kind of pointing out some conflicts.
We tried our best. And I think at the end of the day, this is an Oscars movie, man.
I hope so. And we'll see what happens. But I don't know how you walk that line and you mend those two worlds of we want to bring back people that we've lost, but also here's Black Klansman, which is nominated for an
Academy
Award.
Stay tuned to the next episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar, where we really break down the best popular film.
Yeah, it's going to be a tricky tightrope, but we'll see what happens. There's going to be a lot to hear and a lot to say about this movie. We want to hear your thoughts and enter into civil discourse about it. Let us know if you think we're way off base with anything we've said. Let us know if you agree or you can nitpick or whatever. We want to know your thoughts about this.
We want to hear from you.
Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on Twitter, Mike, and Oscar at gmail.com, MikeMikeAndOscar.com, Reddit, we're everywhere. Especially if you can give us a couple of likes or a couple of comments on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, we really appreciate it. Those help us go far.
We've had our best week since the week before the Oscars, so we thank all of you.
Thank
you
very much.
You're spreading the word about our show, so we really appreciate it. We're growing during an Oscar, what we thought was going to be an Oscar off season.
Yes.
So that's really cool to see happen. And if you enjoy our stuff, thanks, and thanks for listening, and of course, thanks for spreading the word.
Yeah, and we don't go an hour and a half generally with Oscar Sprint profiles,
right?
But they're also not usually as packed with as much to say as this movie seemed to have. So apologies for the length, but it was necessary on our part today. And
see this movie and talk to us about it, please.
Mike, any final words of wisdom?
Birth of a Nation fucking sucks as a movie. And
not really going out on a limb there, but all right.
Brilliantly used. Well, it's still touted in film history classes.
Yes, because of idiots.
I had to watch this movie in school, and it wasn't like demonized.
Jesus Christ, that's terrible.
Isn't it terrible?
That's awful.
And they said in the movie, Woodrow Wilson thought it was history written with lightning. Fucked up.
Yeah, that is fucked up. You're absolutely right. That's unbelievable that they use that in education. But yeah, good words to end on. Reality sucks. Reality sucks.
Birth of a Nation, if you want, it's on demand. Like, it's VOD right now. You can click on it.
That's fine, I guess.
Yeah.
No, let's give Alex Jones. Let's let him stay on YouTube. Reality sucks, guys. Keep watching movies with us, and we will catch you next time.
See ya. Big Ooga Booga, get to him and talk until you see the ball in the future.